Bibles behind bars. Soon I had all the food I could eat, all the sugar I wanted, and all the juice crystals I desired. Moreover, I had all the respect one could hope for inside. The food helped to heal my foot, and in time, when Priest and then Bucky were moved to a supermax prison, I was chosen to take one of their jobs as quartermaster because the guys on the range knew I was fair and that I'd share. As Lauriston said, all people who give to those around them prosper by them, and all those selfish blood clots that don't get nothing but fire. I just wish I hadn't had to go to jail to figure that out. That and so much else. Before Priest was shipped off, he offered me some advice. Indian, listen. I've exhausted my appeals. It's over for me. The look on his face was of utter defeat and worry. It was an expression I hadn't seen on his face since I'd met him sometime earlier. It'll be all right, bro, I said. Just keep to yourself, read, work out, draw. I'll try, but shit's crazy down there. At least I'll get conjugal visits after a while. Priest cracked a half smile, and his eyes glazed over. Anyways, Thistle, listen. You have two official duties in this job. First, you have to make inmates read the rules when they first enter the range and make them shower. People need to be clean. And if they don't listen, you have to bang them out. You're the first line of defense against disease and nastiness. The guys depend on you. Second, you have to distribute the food fairly, which I know you'll do, because Lauriston taught you well. It was true. Lauriston had taught me the value of sharing and how it maintained order. Is that it? I asked, knowing that the quartermaster job was much more complex. Of course not. You have to keep the dope and tobacco flowing, and you have to pass lighters to other inmates and other ranges. You do that through the cleaners who mop the halls. They come at 8:30 sharp every morning. You pass the lighter to them, they pass it to other inmates, and then they pass it back. It's simple. Here. Priest handed me the purple lighter I'd seen used many times on our range. I grabbed it and rammed it in my jumpsuit pocket. When the screws come to shake down the range, Priest stressed, it's your job to hoop the lighter. You gotta stick it up your ass, and fast. Don't give me that face. I had to do it for 2 years straight. Do you know how many times I've been intimate with that thing? The laugh I let out relaxed Priest for the first time in our conversation. I felt happy he could ease up, if only for a second. Use soap if you can, slip the lighter up. If not, you're taking the dry hammer. It doesn't matter, you get it up there. I know it sucks, but the lighter is power. People can't smoke or do dope without it, and they'll try to steal it from you. To prevent that, you have to buy protection with food. Give it to guys who you want to fight for you, the big guys you work out with. They don't give a shit about you, but they do care where their calories come from. You can bet on that. Got it, I said, picturing myself having to repeatedly hoop the lighter during cell raids. Anything else? Yeah, when new fish come in, you have to take them to the toilet and watch them take a dump. Remember when I did that with you? There was a reason for that. The memory of when I first entered the range shot across my mind. Priest met me at the sally port, made me read the rules, told me to shower, then took me to the toilet and watched me. He had his hand over the flusher the whole time. Once I was done, he pushed me aside and took a rolled-up newspaper and stirred the water, breaking up my waste. Then he told me to shower again. That's how the drugs come in. Some guys come in with suitcases up their asses and ruin the drug trade by driving down prices. You can't let that happen. If someone drops a suitcase in the bowl while you're quartermaster, you have to reach in and grab it and bang the guy out, then give the product to Bucky. It's his market. And don't worry about Bucky. He's got an army in here and will sort out any problems if it involves product. Got it? If you follow those rules, you will be fine. I assured Priest I understood, but I could see he wanted to tell me something else. I waited patiently until he looked comfortable, then asked, "Is there anything more?" "Yes," he said intently. "I've seen a lot of guys hurt really bad in here. Some go to the hospital, some die. You see this book right here?" Priest pointed to his blue jail-issue Bible. "This has a lot of power in it, and it can tell you things about people." I tried to piece together what a Bible and people getting killed in jail had in common, while at the same time hoping Priest wasn't going to get all religious on me. "Lots of people end up in here," Priest said. "Some come to jail on remand, some on misdemeanors, some on transfer, some on breach, and some on really serious charges. Many of the fake cats brag about the crimes they've done. They do this to make themselves out to be badder than they really are, to intimidate others. They say they're bank robbers or jewel thieves or murderers, but really, they got caught with a dime bag of weed in their mother's station wagon at a traffic stop. Whatever they say, remember, braggers get daggers." Priest paused and looked down at the guys pumping water bags at the end of the range. Dudes getting their swole on. "But there are others inside who are real criminals. And there's a way to spot them." "How?" I knew what he was about to say was valuable. "At night, when you're giving out tea for jug up before bed, look at people's bedsides. Look beside the beds of those young punks who brag, then look at the bedside of the quiet guys. You'll see something different." "What?" The question jumped from my lips before I had the chance to stop it. "Those in for real crimes, the serious ones, they always have a Bible, Quran, Torah, or some other holy book by their beds. Night after night, they stay up trying to make it right with God. Don't fuck with guys like that. They'll straight up kill you. The fake criminals, on the other hand, sleep like babies and never keep Bibles by their beds because they don't need forgiveness because they ain't done nothing wrong. The real hard nuts can't sleep and can't stop themselves from seeking God. They need forgiveness because they can't accept who or what they've become and what they've done, or accept the life they've made for themselves. It's a hard pill to swallow, to know you're a monster who's done monstrous things. They got no other comfort than God. Somewhere along the line, it went bad for them." I kept a Bible beside my bed, and I asked, "What went bad, Priest?" "All us criminals start out as normal people, just like anyone else. But then things happen in life that tear us apart, that make us into something capable of hurting other people. That's all any of the darkness really is. Just love gone bad. We're just broken-hearted people hurt by life." There were tears in the corners of Priest's eyes. I could see for the first time the good man this muscle-bound criminal must have once been. The man he must have wished he could still be. I felt a deep sorrow knowing that he had no chances left. The Sallyport buzzer blared and the guards came to collect Priest. He composed himself, gathered his pillowcase of belongings, dapped my fist, and said goodbye. I never saw Priest again. Someone told me that he'd been in for a homicide and a drug deal gone wrong. But I never did find out the details, because that was something he never talked about, except, I assume, in private between himself and God, at night, with a Bible resting beside his bed. Audrey. "I got a car," she said. "We could work together." The gorgeous vanilla scent of her perfume filled my nose, and her deadly smile left me defenseless. I nodded like a moron. I'd seen her around from time to time at some of the trap houses in the neighborhood since getting out of jail. She had straight golden blonde hair and gray eyes plastered with mascara. She was a knockout and didn't look like one of us street people. Her cheeks were full, her body well-formed, and she had expensive clothes. She intimidated me at first. Then she introduced herself. "Hello," she said. "My name is Audrey." My heart jumped at her East Coast accent. "What's your name?" I was too enamored to form a coherent response. She twirled her hair on her index finger and giggled. I was in love. I learned that she lived around the corner in her own apartment. She was impressed that I fended for myself, begging and stealing, and did it without drug dealing. "I don't believe in dope dealing," she said. "It's poisoning our kind. Broken-hearted people with nowhere to be in the world." I related to that. I wonder how she kept a car on the road with such a serious crack addiction, but I never asked. It was none of my business. One of the working girls who frequented many of the same dope spots wasn't a fan. "She takes away all the business," she said when I asked her who Audrey was. "I wish she'd leave some for us." One day, when I brought in about $200 of stolen meat I'd pinched from the grocery store, Audrey was sitting in the back room of the trap house, watching the goings-on. I got my standard 1/3 the retail price for the haul and exchanged it for crack. "A girl can do a lot with a guy like you, Jesse," Audrey said as she eyed me up and down, then looked at my rock. We went back to her place that night. I thought we were going to have sex, but we just smoked until the dope ran out and talked until our jaws hurt about where she was from and how she wanted out of the life we were both caught up in. I didn't make any moves towards her. I figured she got that all the time, pigs invading her body. She made up some blankets for me on the couch and said, "Anytime you need a place to crash, you're welcome to stay." She covered me up, then went to sleep alone in her bedroom. I dreamt of her the whole night. The next day, we did our first run together. We hit about 12 grocery stores. I went in with my gym bag, filled it with steak, shrimp, baby formula, razors, and makeup until it damn near broke from the weight. She waited outside, her van revving. A couple of times, security guards chased me out, but I just hopped in the van, and she floored it to our next destination. The excitement in Audrey's face, the way we cheered and held hands as we sped away, like we'd accomplished something, turned me on. It made my foot feel better, made me feel better about myself, made me feel better about everything. We made a great team. When we cashed out in the evening, we had more dope than we could smoke. I fried up a few steaks and we had dinner at her place like real people. Soon our scams became more complex. The easiest was the water bottle hustle. I'd go into a grocery store and grab 2 huge water bottles, the ones worth $10 when they're returned empty, and carry them out. If I wasn't followed, I'd dump out the water, go back in, and return them. I got $20 for 5 minutes of work. Simple as pie. If store security did come after me, I'd drop the bottles in the parking lot, then rush away. Security had the choice of either chasing me down or staying with the merchandise. They couldn't do both. If they did leave the bottles for someone else to steal, that someone was Audrey. She'd drive behind the action, pick up the bottles, then speed ahead and grab me before I was busted. That was the best scenario, because we just returned them somewhere else down the road. Again, an easy 20. If security guards stayed with the bottles, Audrey would just drive ahead and pick me up, and we'd try it again somewhere else. In all 3 scenarios, I always got away safe. It was brilliant. We did it all day. We hit liquor stores, too. We used what we called our blitzkrieg maneuver there, our most daring, but also our most lucrative. We could make upwards of $200 or $300 a pop. I'd rush in and grab the first big bottles in sight, maybe 5 at a time. Then I'd make for the front doors and dive headfirst into the van. She'd hit the gas, back doors wide open, my legs dangling halfway out. I must have looked like a baseball player stealing second base. Audrey was one hell of a driver, fast and fearless, rubber wheels screeching through red lights and stop signs like she was Steve McQueen on meth. Often, we'd look back at the pack of angry floor walkers standing and screaming, shaking their fists at the van, and we'd yell at the top of our lungs, cheering our victories. When the liquor stores caught on, we shifted to beer stores. Given the weight and size of beer cases, the runs didn't make as much money, but we still made hundreds of dollars over the course of the day. All of it went to crack. We got thinner. There was a swagger about us, a strange kind of confidence, like we were rock stars or something. We were ghetto rock stars, just not the kind with guitars. And we partied like there was no tomorrow. No matter how much money we got, though, it was never enough. And the excitement was fleeting. Now, looking back on it, we were high, wild, and borderline out of our minds. I can't believe what we did. I regret it all. In a matter of weeks, it all fell apart. I was sitting at the end of Audrey's couch drinking a bottle of booze we'd just stolen, waiting for our nightly steaks to grill up. There was a giant pile of crack between us, our day's keep. "I know you want me," Audrey slurred, drunk off her face. She cozied up to me and put her hand on my lap, sliding it toward my crotch. It felt weird. We'd never been intimate before, even though I'd wanted her since we met. I sat frozen. She didn't look so hot anymore. It wasn't like she'd changed so much as to not be physically attractive. She was still a bombshell. It's just that I didn't like it when she talked and acted this way. Nor did I like what we'd become. I thought we could make a real go of life together, get jobs, clean up, stay out of trouble. I just wanted us to be something better, and I didn't want to ruin it. It was silly to think this way because it was clear that we were addict thieves, partners in crime, good at it too, and that we adored each other and got along great. I just had too many feelings to take advantage of her. I loaded up the pipe and gave it to her to distract her. She knocked it out of my hand and leaned in for a kiss. I reciprocated. My soul exploded, but it felt wrong. I pulled back. "I can't," I said. I think I love you." I reached for her hand. I wanted to explain myself about how I wanted to wait. "Don't," she said, sounding hostile. She hoisted herself to the edge of the couch and almost face-planted on the table. Her knee knocked over our little crack mountain, and a portion of it tumbled onto the carpet. I sat speechless. I knew I'd crossed a line. "Take your half and get out," she said, not looking at me. "I'm done with you." She walked over to the front door and held it open. "Out." I didn't argue as I collected my belongings and left. We didn't even say goodbye. Dynamite. The wick on the stick of dynamite stuck out of my parka about 5 inches. I tucked it into my breast pocket as I headed to the dope house. My crack dealer's name was Green, a gang member from Rexdale, Ontario, and his homies all had colors for names. I assume they got the idea from Reservoir Dogs. Green told his mates that I was dangerous and willing to do anything. He was right. I had no fear of death after Samantha and I broke up and what happened with Audrey and Flip. Everyone was impressed that I'd robbed the convenience store and that I'd eluded cops with a cast on my leg. They started calling me Hot Boy. I hated the moniker, but it gave me a kind of respect, homeless or not. Piles of snow shimmered in the dusk as I hurried past the mechanic shop. The red stick felt heavy against my chest, like an iron bar. The OxyContin I'd taken 3 hours earlier was wearing off. My foot was hurting like it'd been crucified with a 6-inch railway tie. The staph infection had come back. Cold crept into my ankle and seized the wires holding my foot together. I couldn't run without the aid of pills, and pain could halt my mission. "It doesn't matter," I resolved. "I'm going to get a giant rock from those dealer scum whether I'm high or not." My jaw muscles flexed and snapped the tooth I'd got fixed in jail. I spit the fragment on the sidewalk and it bounced off into a snowbank. A vision of Vancouver in the car came to me. I wanted revenge for the person they turned me into. I whipped out my crack stem, loaded it with my last $20 rock, and lit it. I needed that extra push forward. Yellow flames licked the glass, and the rock melted, releasing a stream of thick smoke. It sizzled like Rice Krispies covered in milk. A gush of spit poured out of my mouth and thwacked onto the ice below. It froze into a beautiful spider web of crystals, making tiny squeaking noises as it formed. In an instant, my hearing had sharpened to superhuman levels. I spun around 360 degrees, scanning for the legion of hidden cops I knew tracked my every movement. I saw nothing, but sensed they were close. Once I'd found a tracking device in my baseball cap, in the button on top. People told me it was just there to hold the hat together, but I did not believe them. I ripped it off and chucked it into the Etobicoke River to evade capture. These tracking cops, I'd figured out, also sent coded messages to each other using car license plate numbers. 9 meant they were close. 2 or 5 meant they had a lock on my whereabouts and were moving in. I saw a car with a license plate, with a 2 and a 5, and it even slowed as it passed. I searched around for cover. I contemplated diving into the bush but decided against it. My ears were ringing from the intense crack high, and I almost slipped on the ice and dropped my payload of explosives. The blast of rock also brought out those Ewok-looking shadow creatures who shot death rays at me with their galactic sorcery. Their chatter drove me nuts. They sounded exactly like they did in Star Wars. Me chippy chua, ah ah. Fucking terrifying. They were stealthy creatures melting in and out of the shadows. They reminded me of those demon shadows in Ghost that dragged that Puerto Rican, Willie Lopez, to hell for killing Patrick Swayze after he got hit by that car. I didn't want to end up like him. I lit my pipe again, hoping to rid myself of my paranoia, but an Ewok groaned from the darkness over near the curb. They're coming for me. I ran as fast as I could into the middle of the street where the light was strongest. My heart pounded until it hurt. I slapped my face to snap out of it. I slapped it again to remind myself that none of it was real. My arm knocked loose the dynamite and it tumbled down around my waist inside my jacket. I placed it back in my pocket and continued on. When I got to the dope house, one of Green's men was guarding the door. Hot boy! He hollered as I approached. He held out his fist, and I dapped it. He kept his eyes on my every move. The brown-black hilt of his Glock was exposed in his waistband, his shirt purposely pulled up, warning people not to fuck around. It didn't faze me. Green around? I smirked back, trying to play it cool. I felt a thunderbolt radiate up my leg. The oxy had worn off. Inside, in the basement. He stood up and reached towards me. I jumped back. What the fuck? I said, pushing his hands away from my torso. He was going to pat me down. You know me, dog. His face hardened, and he put his hand near his pistol. New policy. What do you think? I gotta stick a dynamite on me? Chill. I laughed and nudged his shoulder. He laughed back. Wouldn't be surprised. He eyed me one last time, then motioned me towards the door with his head. Go on in. My bluff had worked. I dapped his hand and passed. The house smelled of crack and meth. The walls were caked with a layer of resin, enough to get high on if I scraped it off and smoked it. Half the light bulbs were missing or shattered on the floor. The whole place was lit by candles. A dim light radiated from the bowels of the basement. I steadied myself and made my descent. A few crackheads were in the corner hitting their pipes near the foot of the stairs, and a few tweakers were over near the bathroom smoking broken light bulbs. The door at the back was closed. That was a good sign. It meant the ladies were turning tricks with Johns because there was dope around. No one used that room but them. Green emerged from a door in the hallway. He had a sock in his hand, his trademark dope carryall. It bulged with a load of luscious rocks. "Cracula, my man," he said to me. "What can I do for you?" I stood there a second. I felt the explosive press hard against my ribs. Green must have sensed something was up and backed away. I reached into my coat, yanked out the dynamite, and thrust it above my head. "Give me all your fucking dope or I'll light it," I screamed, and waved the red cylinder around, my lighter held near the wick, ready to ignite it. Green's eyes opened wide, and all the heads in the room spun around, a look of terror on them. Everyone jostled for shelter, tossing their gear. Green backed up against the wall, almost dropping his plump sock. The gunman at the front door appeared at the top of the stairs and stood there motionless, seemingly stunned. Another emerged from the door where Green had been earlier, gun in hand. He, too, was shitting himself. "I'll light it, I swear!" I yelled again. I flicked my lighter. A bead of sweat trickled down my forehead, and I wiped it away on the sleeve of my dynamite arm. Green cracked a smile. That wasn't the reaction I'd hoped for. He grabbed the explosive out of my hand. "A fucking road flare?" He laughed and tugged at the wick, and it fell onto the floor. He sniffed at the red stick like he was examining a fine cigar. "Doesn't smell like sulfur to me." Silence fell over the room like a blanket, until I heard the safeties on the guns click. Green stared at me. I was trapped. I'd picked up the road flare near the gravel pit by my old public school. It looked like a stick of dynamite, so I stuck a piece of string in it to make a wick and hatched a scheme to come to the dope house and threaten maximum carnage to get a rock. I'd gotten the idea from an old story Uncle Ron had told me about when he went into a biker clubhouse with a live grenade to scare the shit out of everyone. It had worked for him, but my plan failed miserably. I waited for Green's men to open fire. To my surprise, Green giggled. "That's why I like you," he said, "because you're fucking crazy, like me." He reached into his sock and pulled out a 20 rock. "Here." He placed it in my hand and waved off his men. "Great joke. You had me for a second." Push-ups. I was in jail in 2007 for assaulting a couple of police officers. I'd done a huge toke of crack after breaking into a car and was having bad hallucinations and thought the Ewok creatures were coming for me. I ran into the middle of the street hollering that I needed help and was dying and losing my mind. From a side road, a van flew at me, then slammed on its brakes, and five huge bearded men jumped out and began chasing me. They looked like bikers. I hobbled as fast as I could, headlong into traffic, cars veering out of the way, horns honking, but the bikers were all larger and faster than I was. They tackled me, but I fought back with all my might until I saw a police cruiser pull up. I knew I'd be safe. The bikers could not murder or kidnap me. But they still choked me from behind, and I almost lost consciousness, my arms punching forward until I heard a loud crack and gurgle in my throat. I was dumped in the back of a paddy wagon, scratching the steel sides and growling like an injured mountain lion in shackles, and brought to Maplehurst, where I was charged with assault with intent to resist arrest times two, possession of a scheduled substance, break and enter, and theft. The guys on the range were impressed that I'd fought off so many undercover police, the bikers as it turned out, and had gone fisticuffs with three uniformed police officers, and in the process rebroke my wrist and fractured my jaw. Truth was, I was just terrified and high, and had gone mad. There was no toughness involved. One. My arms wobbled as I pushed up, hands shoulder width apart, feet together, body straight. The latest song from Rihanna blasted across the protective custody range in the jail in Milton, Ontario. A dank scent of male swamp entered me as I sucked in air for energy. Choo! The pressure increased in my head as my sternum touched the floor, and my wrist throbbed, but then my arms straightened again. I peered down at myself and saw a rack of bones, and a stomach that sucked back toward my spine. My skin was gray and lifeless. Three. I gritted my teeth and felt a burn in my triceps as I dipped down and up another time. There was a tightness in my core I hadn't felt for years. These were the first set of push-ups I'd attempted to do since I'd been arrested again. Four. I tried with all my might to keep straight, but as my nose touched the floor first, my bum shot in the air. I glanced over at my cellmate, who was drinking his orange crystal drink out of an empty shampoo bottle. A stain of blood near his foot had seeped into the pores of the cement. Five. Faintness overtook me. I kept going. My blue jail underwear dangled low, finding the ground before I touched down and hoisted myself up again. The echo of the cell wasn't as bad as the hole, but it still made focusing difficult. Six. Halfway down, my muscles failed. My arms locked and wouldn't push up anymore. I gave it one more go. They wouldn't budge. I tucked my legs underneath my bum and pulled myself upright using the side of the steel table. I swayed as my knees buckled and I found myself clinging to the bars of the cell. Last thing I remember was my hands letting go, then the hollow sound of my skull smashing onto the pavement. When I awoke, I was in another wing of the jail with an attendant hovering above me. "You shouldn't be exercising, Mr. Thistle," he said. "Your blood pressure is too low. You're still too emaciated." "But how am I supposed to defend myself?" I asked. I tried to raise my arms but couldn't. I swallowed and heard a click in my throat. "I wouldn't worry about that right now." He pulled back the cover, revealing my foot. "The disease in here is way more serious than the other inmates." I wasn't sure if he was talking about my infection or the detention center. Inception. I saw a guy on our range at the Sallyport talking with an older man in a red and gray uniform. The geezer wasn't stiff like the guards. He had a peaceful presence about him, but still a hardness about his body language, like he'd been one of us, like he'd done time in the past. "Who is that?" I asked my cellmate. "That's the chaplain." I watched as the inmate gave the chaplain an envelope and took a pile of papers to the back table where he always sat. When I walked over and asked him what he was doing, he said, "I'm getting my high school. You do that through the chaplain. It's a great way to pass the time." I observed him for about a week. He was quiet, the mark of a true gent, just like Priest said. He never bragged or talked bad or gambled chocolate bars or traded dope. The guy just did his time real classy-like. I admired that. I thought maybe I could make a better life for myself in those books, too, like he was trying to do. Or maybe it was silly. "I'd like to try that out," I said to him one day after I'd finished working out with the water bags. "School, give it another go." He lifted his head from his notes. "But I can't read too good. I dropped out a long time ago, and years of drugs and hard living, well, it's kind of done my head in." "Nah, it's easy. Don't believe those lies." He turned around a piece of paper. "This is my reading assignment here. Try reading the first line." My eyes had trouble focusing. I stumbled and stuttered, and I messed up pronouncing a few words. But I eventually got through it. "See? Walk in the park. I can help you out if you want." A week later, I received my first assignment from the chaplain in English. I got help with my reading from other inmates when I needed it and handed in my work the following week. A month later, I got an 85% on the final. Something within me shifted. Philosophy and world religions classes followed. I got 83% in philosophy. World religions was way harder. I didn't finish because I didn't understand all the big words. The local school board, however, recognized my efforts and gave me 6 maturity credits. 3 months into my sentence, I was only 2 credits short of graduating high school. It was a miracle. Unbeknownst to me, most of the guys on the range were suspicious. Rumors spread that I was flying kites to the screws, squawking, because cell raids always happened right after I'd handed in my homework or sent a letter to Grandma. After I submitted one of my last assignments, I was confronted in the washroom by a group of inmates. "Why would you chirp on your brothers?" they asked, and slammed me against the shower wall. "I'm just trying to finish my schooling," I said, afraid but determined. They roughed me up some, clocked me in the eye a few times, but eventually stopped, satisfied, I assume, by the fact that I didn't break. The Messenger. I had a visitor. I was so excited. No one ever visited or sent me letters, ever. Grandma didn't even respond. That didn't bother me anymore. The guard handcuffed me and took me to the visitor's area. I was surprised to see Jerry on the other side of the plexiglass. Somehow, he'd found my hiding spot again, like he always did. No matter where I ran, to a shelter, jail, or some far-off random street corner across the country, the fucker kept tabs on me and would track me down. Trying to hide from him was like a souped-up version of that TV show Man Tracker, except Jerry didn't have a horse or a cowboy hat, and I wasn't running and leaping through the bush. This, however, was the first time he'd actually come to see me in jail. "So here you are," he said, "hiding like a frightened rat. When is this going to stop?" "Fuck you," I said. "I'll go back to my cell. You watch." "Then go. Go back to your hole and die alone, you sad, sad man." I wanted to kick the plexiglass and have it shatter in his pudgy face, blinding him for life. "I see through all your macho bullshit," he said. "Always have. One day I'm going to stop searching. Then you'll be fucked." I fidgeted with my coveralls. "You put up all these walls to keep people out. Literally, look around. I just don't have the energy to break them down anymore. No one does. I'm the last. No one else gives a shit anymore. I had to dig really deep to come here to see you today. I hate seeing you penned in like some animal, but I forced myself to do it because I have a message." I looked up at him. "Grandma's sick. She doesn't have many years left. You living like this is hurting her, and it makes me want to beat you up, seriously. She's been waiting all these years for you to stop living this way. If she dies and you're like this, you'll never recover. I hope you realize that." I slammed my fist on the counter in front of me and closed my eyes. I didn't know what to do. When I opened them, I saw Jerry's hand pressed hard against the plexiglass. I didn't dare lift my hand to his, but looked up at him. "See? I knew you were still in there. That's the little brother I remember." As soon as he said that, the buzzer of the timer went off. Our visit was over. As the guard snapped the cuffs back onto my semi-healed wrists, I turned and saw Jerry's hand still on the glass, his eyes locked onto mine. A couple weeks later, I was released with time served. I felt hopeless. I'd come so close to finishing high school, only to be released right before I could see it through, to be released right back to the life that I knew was killing me slowly. I was in bondage to the dealers, a 24-hour money-generating machine, and the thought of lurching forward and the pain that shot up my leg with every step in the desert out there terrified me.
Steak knife. I was stealing bikes from people's backyards. My dealers took them $30 a pop without question. I desperately needed the money to get high. I had been up for a week solid since being released from jail, and my addictions were worse than ever. The street I was on in Brampton is gang territory. Crack in Brampton traveled through there before being distributed throughout Peel County. I shouldn't have been jacking bikes there. I knew better. But I was desperate, and my mind wasn't working well. Jail time had softened my begging and thieving skills, too. People just didn't believe my lies anymore. "You're a healthy young man," they'd say. "You should be working." I spotted a BMX bike with gold pegs and chrome handlebars and hauled it over a fence. Before it hit the ground, a group of angry young men confronted me from behind. "Hot boy," one of them hollered. "You know this block's off limits." They stripped me of the bike and shoved me into a parking lot. There were five of them, bandanas flying. "Now we gotta make an example of you," the smallest one said, as he circled behind me to cut off my exit. A guy in front of me pulled out a steak knife and lunged at me. The knife hit me right in the mouth. I tumbled to the ground, smashing the back of my head on the concrete. Blood poured down my throat and I choked, but I swung forward wildly, punching up at the sky, the instinct to defend myself kicking in. "Look at him," one guy said. He kicked my ribs repeatedly, pushing me sideways. I felt nothing but heard the dull thuds echo through my body. I saw the knife handle sticking out of my face and covered my head. I heard laughing, followed by the close whine of sirens and wheels grinding on concrete, and raised my head, saw my attackers running off in all directions like cockroaches as a cop car mounted the curb. I yanked the knife out of my face and tossed it in a bush. A stream of blood gushed onto my shirt. It looked like a massacre. My hands fumbled over my head. The left side of my face was numb. There was a hole above my upper lip. I stuck my finger into it and it slid over my front teeth, right down to the bone. A policewoman ran over. "Who did it?" she asked. I stayed quiet, fearful that the people in the complex nearby were listening. She helped me to my feet, then put me in her squad car and drove to the hospital. I was shipped to 21 Division and after charged with theft. Didn't matter. The arrest probably saved my life. Random dude. Name, birth date, social security. The shelter worker rhymed off, thrusting a clipboard at me under the plexiglass. She looked like she was having a rough day, her hair all frizzed out. I grabbed the clipboard. "I don't have ID," I said. "I just got out of jail and I'm going by bus to Ottawa to rehab tomorrow. The chaplain bought me a ticket." I pushed my Greyhound stub against the glass. The rehab center I was going to was Harvest House, a last-chance Christian rehab that took the worst of the worst cases that no other place would touch. I know. I tried calling them all from jail. Given my record, it was my only option. Olive had given me the phone number one day when I called her collect from jail, trying to set up a release plan. "I'm going to be brutally honest with you, Jesse," she said as I scribbled down the digits. "I've known you forever, and you can't make it another season the way you are. You don't look right anymore. Please call." Olive was always so optimistic, so hopeful. She believed God could rescue people even in the most wretched of cases. So to hear her talk this way really caught my attention. I phoned Harvest House the instant I got off the phone with her and discovered that they had GED schooling as well as treatment. I could finish what I'd started and graduate high school. Plus, they'd take me right away. No other program would do that. That gave me such hope. When I told the chaplain, he bought me a one-way ticket and gave me a pair of jeans and a shirt, right before the jail gates opened to freedom. "These don't fit," I said. "Trust me," he told me when he dropped me off at the shelter. "You'll put weight on." The electro-haired lady behind the plexiglass ignored me and my bus ticket, slid a pen through the opening, and started talking with her colleagues. I filled in the form and passed the clipboard back. "Jesse Thistle," she said, and I nodded. She buzzed me in and told me to wait near the front to get my toiletries and to finish the intake process. The shelter was empty, or at least it appeared that way. A few people were playing cards near the doors to the washrooms. A couple were on the phones by the office. I hadn't been to this shelter in months, but had been a regular for years, starting way back in 2001, when they moved it from the old fire hall. I sat down beside an old man with gray hair. His clothes and shoes told me he'd just gotten out of jail or lost his home. They were too nice to be lived in street gear. "Did she say you were Thistle?" he asked, and motioned with his thumb to the office. "Yeah?" I studied his body language and wondered if I should bolt. Thought maybe he could be a friend of Mike and Stefan's. "Was your dad Sonny by chance? I only ever knew one family of Thistles." "Cyril Thistle Jr. is my dad." The man's face changed from hard convict to friendly dog. I noticed a few prison tattoos under his sleeve as he stuck his hand out. "Name's Rodney. I was a good friend of your pop's." I took his hand. "I've never met anyone who's known my dad other than my own family. I'm just on my way to Harvest House in Ottawa. I leave tomorrow. Been there. Treatment. Not Harvest House." The tips of his fingers were burnt and swollen, telltale signs that he suffered the same addiction I did. Only lighters or crack stems burn like that. That, or maybe he was a mechanic. Not likely, I deduced. Working mechanics don't usually stay in homeless shelters. "Your dad was a great man, one of the best in Weston back in the day. Too bad what happened." I nodded. I had no words and just wanted to hear him riff. Thought maybe he'd reveal some details I hadn't heard before, but he fell silent. I finally said, "I wish I knew him." I glanced over to the intake worker, then back, not sure of what was on my new friend's mind. "I grew up at my grandparents'. Last I saw him was when I was 3. I've been keeping an eye out for him." "Keeping an eye out? You know, in case he pops up somewhere. I heard he's homeless. I've been searching all over for years." He shook his head and sat up. "No one told you?" "He's gone, son. They got him in 1982. The lady in the booth called my name, but I didn't move. "Who got him?" "You better go get signed in," he said. "If you don't, they'll discharge you for wasting their time." "Who got him?" I asked again before getting up and walking toward the office, glancing back at him the whole way. He didn't answer. The worker closed the door behind me, and I sat there the entire time thinking of what he'd said. When I emerged, he was gone. The process. I didn't get it right the first time in rehab. No one ever does. I arrived at Harvest House in November 2007 and stayed for 3 months straight. I didn't really work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got there, nor did I dig deep in personal development classes to the root of my addictions, like everyone else. I believed I was better than everyone, than the program. I kind of coasted after the initial detox and withdrawal, white-knuckled it, as they say in AA speak. I stayed dry with no cigarettes, sure, but never really achieved sobriety, even though I thought I did. I just repeated the first drugless day for 90 days. Eventually, dreams of liquor and drugs drove me out into the pitch-black February night with my roommate, Max, another guy who was lackluster about the program. I was in no shape to face old man winter in Ottawa. I didn't own a jacket or even a sweater. I didn't care. All that mattered was that I was free and that I was going to be high and drunk and that I didn't have to listen to the counselors yell at me in group therapy while I avoided revealing any of the resentments about Dad or Josh or Grandpa or Jerry, or read the King James Bible, begging God for a forgiveness I knew I didn't deserve. "Fuck it all. Tonight is mine," I proclaimed. I knew I'd most likely get arrested, so I was going on a tear until my cash ran out and the police caught up with me. I'm going out in a blaze of glory. Max grinned a demonic grin and let out a hellish AC/DC scream, complete with heavy metal devil horns thrust into the air. We made it to the fence, and under the cover of darkness, we scrambled over it. My pants tore open as I leapt to freedom, leaving my balls blowing in the freezing wind. The freedom that first day felt incredible, like I'd been some cooped-up dog who'd discovered the gate left open. Frickin' party time! We arrived at the homeless shelter an hour after we jumped the fence and immediately scored some dope and divided it between us. After the first blast of rock, Max saw an old working girl he dated before his stint in rehab. He waved to me, and they disappeared. I ran to the liquor store, swiped a 60-ouncer of Crown Royal, and slammed it down without even tasting it. Then I went in to steal another to buy a huge chunk of crack. Store security didn't notice me for once, with my full cheeks and laundered clothes. My put-togetherness was like a cloak of invisibility. I went ballistic. I know now that the compulsion to get high had eroded any moral judgment that I had. I was totally out of control. I was doing things like ripping open payphones and shoplifting in what felt like every store in the whole Ottawa area. Razors, bras, makeup, baby formula, shrimp, whatever the cab drivers in front of Rideau Center wanted me to steal, I got for them. They were like my bank account, a 24-hour drive-through cash bar that never closed. I must have been up 14 straight days before I finally fell asleep in the parking garage in the market. By then, I knew I was starting to look like some creature slinking about. And I'd begun to be reduced to begging, worse than I ever was in Brampton, like my addictions had been at the bottom of the Harvest House driveway, doing push-ups, getting stronger than before, waiting for me to fuck up. The meaning is gone. I retreated into darkness. I walked along the boulevard in Ottawa, and the colors of the storefronts drained down across the sidewalks, faded under the blackened snowbanks, and seeped into storm grates, gray on gray, followed by more gray. The city hummed its droning hum, a cacophony of horns and car tires rotating across slick pavement, splashing through puddles. People hustled past me as I limped forward, my bowels loosened and let go, sending a stream of waste down my legs. I held it in the best I could, stopping several times to ask store employees if I could use their washrooms, but they'd said, "Sorry, for paying customers only," before ushering me back out into the cold. I shuffled into an alley and attempted to clean myself with a discarded chip bag. After, I asked a restaurant for napkins, and they refused and grimaced. It was impossible to hide my shame. I steadied myself against a bus stop, pulled out a bottle of Listerine, and took a swig, hoping that the antiseptic would cleanse my spiritual wounds. Mouthwash was the best I could do. Most of the liquor stores had caught me stealing and wouldn't let me in. I heard the LCBO even had pictures of me in their back rooms. When the noxious fluid hit my belly, it torched my intestines, but worked its dark magic. I faded into a groggy chemical drunk, the kind that obliterated existence into fragments, just like I liked. My digestive system was in tatters. The past few weeks, I'd been puking blood mixed with bile, a sour, putrid liquid that burned when it came up. It made eating near impossible, save for a dry slice of toast or some weak chicken broth. The lack of regular meals caused my throat to close up. It hurt in the most ungodly way when I tried to force anything down it. The shelter staff worried. They'd come over and ask me why I wasn't eating. I never answered. It was none of their business, and they could fuck off as far as I was concerned. They didn't even know my real name. A passerby paused and said, "I don't have any money." I hadn't asked. He looked me up and down, then glanced at my bottle of Listerine. "Fuck your money," I said. "Cocksucker." I belched caustic air in his direction, then took another swig. It burned as though I'd eaten a forest fire. My stomach contracted, and bile shot onto my shoes and the sidewalk. The rose color of it used to frighten me, but I didn't care anymore. I wiped my hand across my mouth and started toward the giant tiger, where I hoped to steal a new pair of pants. My legs were like wooden stilts underneath my baggy, soiled jeans, knobby knees knocking. It took all the strength I had just to keep steady, my vision wavering. I gave up on my mission after a few labored steps. The smell of bread from the bakery on the corner made me think of my grandma and our Christmases in Brampton. There was an ember of that time still alight within me. I inhaled deeply, hoping to set it ablaze. Nothing. The memory passed. My stomach gurgled and I searched the ground for lost change and cigarette butts. I found nothing but garbage, more dirty looks, and a bench out in front of a bar. My foot was numb, and I decided to take a rest. I wouldn't be able to fish change from the Centennial Flame Fountain on Parliament Hill, either. I'd gotten so used to the pain from my ankle that I routinely forgot about the gaping sore. It'd been over 2 years since the operation. The hole was the size of a dime, but the flesh around the edge of it was white and shriveled, like skin submerged in water too long, and it expelled a gray-green ooze that crusted yellow when it dried. It reeked like the dead. My foot, too, used to frighten me, but now I was indifferent. A song came on the loudspeaker of the bar. I turned my head to listen, wondering if I recognized it. I didn't. I didn't recognize much anymore. Not music or movies or anything. Signs blurred into smears of jumbled incomprehension. Faces, too. I was a wild animal, a stray wolf with matted fur covered in filth. One not even a dog catcher would want to mess with. The world screamed past me. I lived amongst the Ewok shadows. I groaned misery and shifted as they did. I longed to be part of something again, to be known and accepted, to hear my name. No one ever said my name anymore. I never told anyone who I was for fear of being found out. For what? I didn't know. I'd forgotten years ago. I slumped forward on the bench and held my head in my hands, trying to remember how my name sounded. I spelled it aloud to myself. J-E-S. S.E. Jesse. I smiled, but molten bile bubbled up in my throat, followed by the rude smell of feces, bringing me back to the street. Olive was right. My body was giving out. It wasn't strong enough to endure any more punishment. Salvation and the Soup Kitchen Lady. Hey, you! A voice called up to me, "Get down from there!" It was some woman. I paid her no heed on my ascent to the summit of the half-completed building on Rideau Street. I said, "Get down, or I'll call the cops." My bony hand grasped the edge of a roughly finished ledge. My muscles may have atrophied somewhat from addiction and soup kitchen slop, but I was still as spry as Gollum of Middle Earth looking for his precious. "What do you care?" I shot back. "Beat it." "Why do all these do-gooders keep fucking with me?" I muttered to myself. "Why can't they just mind their own goddamn business?" I hoisted myself up another floor. "I work over at the Shepherds of Good Hope shelter. I've seen you on the bread lines." The pitch of her voice raised the higher I went. "So what?" I replied without looking down. Her efforts were useless. I'd worked out my plan in jail. After I got released, I was going to climb to the top of a construction tower, close my eyes, spread my wings, and float away, crack cocaine and alcohol coursing through my brain for courage. I'd had enough. If shuffling around on the streets like a homeless rat on cocaine was bad, a recent stint in jail in the nation's capital was worse. It wasn't like in Maplehurst with Bucky and Priest. Here, I got no respect. No one would take my calls, not family, not friends. Rapists and murderers got their calls taken, but not me. And letters, forget about it. I'd wait every day at the front of the range for word from the outside world, and every day I was disappointed. I shouted down to the woman on the ground, "Listen, lady, I'm just going to sleep up here because it's safer than on ground level. It's still winter weather and it's cold as hell. You'll freeze up there." A gust bit through my H&M hoodie, and I felt weak all of a sudden. "Listen, can you just leave me be? I just want to be left alone." "I don't believe you." I quickened my pace. I didn't want to lose my nerve, so I reached for the next floor. My hand slipped on some ice, and I fell onto my back on the floor below. Writhing, I almost rolled off the edge. "You almost got what you came for," she shouted. Gasping for air, my heart racing, I curled up and covered my ears, trying to hide from both her incessant voice and what had just happened. "Hey, you know what? I think I do know you. You told me about your grandmother and your brother. You said your name was Jesse or something." The sound of my own name dropped into my consciousness like a sledgehammer. The tears creeping along the bridge of my nose froze as I thought of my grandma and Jerry. Memories that shattered and warmed me at the same time. The woman below was right. I did know her. I could hear her yelling again. "You said you missed them and wanted to make them proud. I remember." I rolled over and peeked over the edge. Sure enough, it was her, black hair hanging down behind her shoulders as she looked up at me. "Come on now, enough of this nonsense," she said with a big smile. "Get down and let's get you some soup and socks, eh?" I picked myself up and began my long descent. When I got to the bottom, she greeted me with a brisk hug. "That was close." "Sure was," I replied. Reconciliation, 2008 to 2017. Fighting the darkness. Once, in a not-too-distant life, I was a different person. It was a dark time, loveless, cold, violent. A time when I no longer cared about the world. A world that had taken so much and left me with nothing. Witticle, monster. I lived by the criminal's creed. Live for today, forget the past, damn the future. I took what I wanted, stole what I needed, and robbed when I could. Dwelling in the shadows, amongst the murderers and thieves, the highwaymen and outlaws. That's how I can fight the darkness now, because I once was the darkness, an apparition driven by the worst part of the human soul, a beast lost in resentments, once in a not-too-distant life. Dawn of the Bronze Age. "We followed a trail of money from the scene of the crime," the constable told his fellow officers, "right to where he was smoking crack in front of the Shepherds of Good Hope. Can you believe that?" It was shamefully true. For my very last crime, the cops had literally caught me red-handed. I put up little resistance when they chucked me in the back of the squad car. I'd had enough. I faced break-and-enter charges and was processed at the Elgin Street Police Station in a nice part of town I rarely ventured into, except when arrested. Then I was shipped to the Ottawa Carleton Detention Center, OCDC. So there I was, once again, heckling the screws and counting the days and cinder blocks. Those cinder blocks seemed to follow me wherever I went. The ones found in jails, mental institutions, probation offices, hospitals, detox centers, detention centers, shelters, Sally Ann's, welfare offices, court holding cells, police station bullpens. I hated the monotony of doing time, but if I was sick of anything, it was seeing those institutional 16x8s. I once counted around 180 of them in my cell at the Don Jail in Toronto, around 190 at Maplehurst in Milton, Ontario, and around 160 at OCDC. But Harvest House Rehab Center had over 360 blocks per dorm room. That made it like the Ritz-Carlton to me. I called Harvest House dreaming of their abundance of blocks, hoping to get someone to vote for me in court and bail me out. The intake worker picked up the phone. "Have you had enough of the life of the Stone Age, Thistle?" Employees at Harvest House could be so smug. "Come get me out of here," I begged. "I'm sick of it all, and I'm especially sick of this jail food. Reminds me of crappy retirement scraps they feed old people." "What? You don't like steamed dog food?" he laughed. 11 days later, someone from Harvest House came and bailed me out, and I was released directly back into rehab, where I could do my dead time before sentencing. The judge who granted my surety said that if I made it the year in rehab, it could serve as my jail time.
"But if you skip out, Mr. Thistle, we will find you and send you down to the darkest prison we have, because the justice system has had quite enough of your nonsense."
The pound of his gavel scared the shit out of me. A few hours later, I was back at Harvest House, shaking and vomiting and praying for mercy. But it was a chance at redemption, and I was grateful for it.
Running on glass.
The laces on my blue Asics were discolored and frayed, evidence of previous ownership, but they were brand spanking new to me, and I loved them for what they were, a second chance. The shoes had been donated to Harvest House by the local running room. All the guys got them when they came to rehab. Some guys mocked them, but they were the ones who relapsed and ended up back in the can within weeks. Those who appreciated them lasted a little longer, but still seemed to go back eventually, usually within 2 or 3 months. Harvest House director Gary Wand was a recovering addict like us who had turned to running to get sober some 15 years earlier when he washed up on the front lawn of Harvest House from Montreal. Everyone at the center said he'd been worse off than all of us, and his entry photo, taken the day he arrived at Harvest House, seemed to confirm that. He looked like a real bag of shit in it. Juan now ran the running program at Harvest House and had arranged the shoe donations. The concept of running as therapy was brilliant, actually. "The dopamine from running affects the same part of the brain as coke," he said. "Running quells cravings." Lots of guys were in the program, and those who did the 10 or 20 kilometer runs instead of just running away to smoke cigarettes seemed to fight relapse better. I wanted what they had. I thought if I ran, I might have a chance to stay clean and honor my surety. I had to go all the way this time around, give it my best. If Wando can do it, I can do it, I said to myself as I hobbled onto the driveway for the daily 5 kilometer jog. The reality of my foot, however, quickly snuffed out my newfound courage, replacing it with doubt and apprehension. It was withered and meatless, bones popping out where flesh should be, and the pins and screws holding my heel together dug into my ankle joint whenever I took a step. I'd never run on it without vast amounts of drugs or alcohol to numb the pain.
"Gary, I'm scared," I said as the pack gathered. "I don't know if my foot will hold."
The grind of pebbles under shoes drowned me out as everyone began running. I waddled to catch up. I must have looked like a penguin shuffling against the wind on a sheet of ice. Gary looked back at me and smiled.
"Just go slow. Trust me," he said, and turned to join the others.
"Go slow," I shot back. "Are you fucking kidding me?" No response.
"Fuck you,"
I yelled. It was no use. Everyone had already gone. I looked down. My damaged foot was longer than the other one, due to the surgery, and the leg it was attached to was atrophied and resembled a sad dollar store broomstick, the hollow kind that bends if you sweep too hard. "Will it bend and break if I run?" I contemplated.
Better that than my foot falling apart.
I laughed out loud at the image of both gruesome scenarios, even though I felt like crying. Then Grandpa popped into my head.
Get going, I heard him bark in his thick Cape Breton accent. Get going and stop feeling sorry for yourself.
It had been a long time since I thought of the old man. But there he was, kicking my ass again, as always. I got pissed off and let go and ran. I didn't think about it. I just put one foot in front of the other and went. I tilted and slipped on stones. My leg and foot buckled and shook and wobbled, but they held. I had no push or spring to my gait. Burning pain shot up from my ankle to my brain, and the bottom of my foot felt like I was running on broken glass, but it was bearable. Is this how it feels for babies to walk? I wondered. As soon as that thought ran through my head, my leg gave out and I tumbled into a cloud of dust and pebbles. The dirt in my mouth tasted glorious.
Holy Christ! I did it! I exclaimed.
At last. My hand shook as I dialed the number Nicole, the CEO of Harvest House, had given me. I sat listening to the phone ring. When it clicked, I panicked and hung up. I sat staring at the dial pad. It seemed to get bigger the longer I gazed at it. I dialed again, and again I hung up when I heard an answering click. I just don't have it in me yet. What do I say to her? Earlier that day, Nicole had come to my bedside in the dorm room and asked me into her office. She was solemn as I took a seat. I thought I was in trouble for violating a rule. What? I wasn't sure. I got an email today, she said. She typed something into her computer. I thought for sure the police were bringing a new charge against me for something I'd done from somewhere, some time ago. The long arm of the law was something I always dreaded, but had to accept now, in my second attempt at sobriety. There's no other way to say this, Nicole said, her eyes welling up, but she was smiling. So not the cops. I was puzzled. I'll just let you read it, she said. She turned her screen toward me, and I saw the email. Hello. I've been trying to contact my son Jesse Thistle for quite a while, and he's never where I'm told he is. I heard he was in Harvest House, and I'm sure God had a hand in it. It's a long story, but I haven't talked to Jesse for a long time, and I don't know what problems he has anymore. I hope he's not suffering too much. Our family was torn apart a long time ago, and I wasn't able to be around Jesse too much. But he always seemed to calm down around me. Anyway, if he is there, tell him I'm happy he's getting help if he needs it. I love him very much, and please just let me know if he is there. If he needs anything, socks, underwear, whatever, let me know, and I'll try to send it. Thank you. Blanche Morissette. It was my mom. I couldn't believe it. I held my head low, but my emotions rolled out and down my cheeks onto my lap. I dialed my mom's number one more time and tried to steady my nerves. Ring! It was picked up straight away this time. A shaky, small voice answered. Hello? It sounded like an old lady, not the mom I remembered from the snowy mountains. Mom? Was all I could muster before losing my breath. I tried to say more, but couldn't. Jesse, is that you? I'm not sure if I answered her, but we both began crying. Not sobs, more like sweet sucks of air. The silence between us saying more than any words. Finally, she told me that she'd been searching for me for 10 years, since just after she saw me in Vancouver at Josh's wedding. In shelters, in the jail system, at places I lived in for a spell, in mental health facilities and detoxes all over Ontario, and at Jerry's. You were like a phantom, she said. I almost caught up to you a couple of times, but always just missed you. I'm sorry life has been this way for you. I'm sorry I wasn't there.
I'd forgiven her before the words even left her lips. The rest of our conversation melted into a drizzle of emotions that fogged my heart in the nicest way, like a silent summer rain that lightly quenches the prairie after a long drought, or the cloud of droplets that kick up at the bottom of a waterfall, delicately misting your face, refreshing and warm, like I'd rediscovered some fragment of home, some lost piece of myself. It filled me up.